From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton. Mosquitoes carry some of the world's most dangerous and widespread diseases, from malaria and dengue fever in the developing world to West Nile virus right here in the Central Valley. Researchers have added a gene to one species of mosquito to block the muscles that let it fly. When those mosquitoes breed with native mosquitoes, the result is mosquitoes that can't fly and therefore can't bite. My guests are researchers who work in various locations in North and Central America, and they join me by phone. They are Anthony James, a molecular biologist at UC Irvine, and closer to home, Thomas Scott is a mosquito field trial veteran from UC Davis who is working in Tapachula, Mexico. Gentlemen, welcome to Insight. Thomas, you're working at the border at Guatemala in Guatemala,
yeah,
Mexico?
It's a project in southern Mexico that's designed to do trials in a large outdoor field cage to determine the efficacy of a genetically modified mosquito to basically reduce the population density of the mosquitoes.
And what's your expertise? You're working in the field for a long time with mosquitoes?
Yeah, I started as a mosquito ecologist, but over the years have become more involved in the epidemiology of mosquito-borne disease. So really what I focus on is different strategies for improving surveillance and prevention, and this is one of many different strategies that I'm interested in. My primary goal is to prevent mosquito-borne diseases, and I focus primarily on dengue.
And could you describe for us exactly how this is done? We don't have Anthony right now, and hopefully we will, but how is this done to modify the mosquitoes?
Well, the mosquitoes have a construct that is inserted into them that affects the development of flight muscles. So it's a genetic construct, so that, and it's female specific. So the female mosquitoes, which are the only ones that take a blood meal and therefore could transmit dengue virus, they can't fly. If they can't fly, then they wouldn't be able to locate a human host and take a blood meal from them. The males, on the other hand, can fly, and they carry this gene. So then when they mate with females, they would the female progeny would not be able to fly. So it's called it's a modification of what's called a sterile insect technique, where you produce males that when they mate with females, they don't produce viable offspring. And so the idea is to reduce the population density of competent females so that they couldn't transmit the virus.
And it kind of raises the question for me is, what do males live on? If the males feed on blood, what do the males live on?
Well, both the males and females can feed on sugars, and the males feed primarily on plant sugars, so carbohydrates. The females of the species that transmits dengue virus don't do that so often because they feed almost exclusively and frequently on human blood.
Okay, and dengue fever is what we've been talking about here, but malaria is also a problem.
Malaria is a huge problem, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where there's a great deal of mortality associated with infections in children, mostly under the age of five. Dengue is, and malaria is found around the world, but the mortality problem is largest in sub-Saharan Africa. Dengue is an increasing problem. It's a different sort of pathogen. It's a virus, and it's found around the globe in the tropics, primarily in Latin America and in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, I'm sad to say I've actually had dengue fever, and it was horrible.
It's not fun.
It's worth wiping out.
And I have antibodies, but I didn't. I was fortunate; I didn't get sick.
Now you're working in Mexico. How's that work being received there?
Well, actually, I work in a number of different places. Like I indicated earlier, I'm interested in a variety of different approaches to prevention of dengue. And like I said, this is just one of them. But I have long-term studies in Peru and Thailand. But this one in Mexico was actually received quite well because we worked very closely with an ethicist. And also our Mexican colleagues put a considerable amount of effort in terms of community engagement. So we worked closely in terms of the acquisition of the land where the cages were built from the community that we purchased that land from, and they were involved in the various field studies that we did, the construction of the cages. They were informed all the way through. So it was well received, and they were kept informed about the progress on the project.
And this is quite a project, it sounds like. If you're buying property and setting these things up, and how long a period of time has this project been going on, and how much longer do you expect it to be going?
Well, it was a 5-year project, and it's essentially coming to an end in the next couple of months. Right, what we're doing right now is analyzing the results from some of the final experiments that we did, and then we need to get together to make sure that we're interpreting those correctly before we make a public announcement about what they are. But it was a 5-year project, and we worked very closely with Mexican colleagues in the Mexican National Institutes of Health.
And how is this funded?
This is funded from a grant from the foundation of the NIH, which received their funds from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It was part of what's called the Grand Challenges in Global Health, which was a program that was started about 5 or 6 years ago. And the idea was to explore novel and innovative ways to prevent infectious disease.
And in the article that I read, it says you refer to building the mosquitoes, which I think is an interesting way of looking at it. But you really are remaking this species, or at least half of it.
Well, I don't know if I would say that. I think that what we had a corporate partner, Oxitec in Oxford, England, and they inserted genes into the mosquitoes. So I wouldn't say we were recreating a species. They modified it so that the progeny of, again, of the males that mated with wild-type females would not be viable and couldn't reproduce, couldn't bite, and so you'd get a reduction in the population density of competent vectors.
Okay, I'm sad to say that we're not going to have Anthony James on the phone. We're having trouble with the phone, so it's all you. But I'm speaking with Thomas Scott, who is working at Chapultepec, Mexico, near the Guatemalan border, on genetically modifying mosquitoes in order to reduce the spread of malaria and particularly dengue fever in this hemisphere, it sounds like. But this would be something that you would be able to use in any area, or is this specific to this one species of mosquito?
It's specific to this particular species of mosquito, and from my perspective, other people might have different points of view, but I think it would be context-specific in terms of how you could use it. So this would be a strategy where you would have to release the males bearing this construct. And so it would probably be something that you do in a subscribed area, like an island or an area that I don't think that this is something that you could use across continental Southeast Asia. It'd be something that would be more geographically subscribed.
And why is that?
Well, that's because you have to release the male mosquitoes, and you'd have to continue to release them to prevent to keep the populations down low, because mosquitoes from outside the area would be introduced, and just logistically it would be really a monumental undertaking to do it over a very large geographic area.
So
some of the other strategies that people have talked about, so you may have heard about Wolbachia recently, which is a bacteria that infects mosquitoes, and it has been used by a group in Australia in some trials they did. The idea is to use it to prevent a dengue. It actually spreads, so it would move through a population. The strategy that we're talking about does not do that. It does not spread.
Mm-hmm. Do mosquitoes serve a useful function? I mean, in getting rid of this this ability for mosquitoes to fly, is there a downside to this?
I don't think there is a downside to removing Aedes aegypti. It's also it's called the yellow fever mosquito. It's the same mosquito species that transmits yellow fever in urban environments. It's a mosquito that has spread around the world from Africa, so in a sense it's an invasive species. I don't think that it plays an important role in any ecological food chain, so I don't think it would be a bad thing if you eliminated Aedes aegypti. Also transmits chikungunya virus, which you may have heard about recently. There were, a few years ago, huge epidemics around the globe.
Of which virus was that, sorry?
Chikungunya.
Okay, I've not heard of that. And that was a relatively recent virus?
Well, it's been around for a long time. There was an outbreak India and in parts of the Pacific. And the virus actually adapted to a different mosquito species, Aedes albopictus, and was transmitted at a very high rate and caused a lot of disease.
I'm pleased to say that we have actually got Anthony James now on the phone, who's a molecular biologist at UC Irvine. Are you there, Anthony?
Yes, I am.
Terrific. Good to have you. I just asked Thomas, but I'll ask you as well. You've been working here mostly stateside, or you did go down to Mexico?
Actually, the collaboration I have is with a large group of people, and while I'm responsible for the overall project, Dr. Scott has been the one who's been the active person who supervised the efforts in Mexico.
Okay, and so what's your role here in California?
So we have a large research laboratory that's devoted to generating the transgenic mosquitoes that are resistant to viral development, dengue virus development, and also some that are part of the population suppression program, the female flightless thing that you might have read about.
Right. And so you basically do these modifications here in the United States and then send the mosquitoes down to the field?
Well, the way it actually works out, we work in collaboration with a company in Great Britain called Oxitec, and we provided components through our research that are built into these things. They actually built the prototypes, and they're the ones that actually shipped them off to Mexico.
Oh, okay. So, where do you see the future of this going? If this works with this particular species, will this conceivably work with other species of mosquito? Because we have different species in different places, right?
That's correct. And I think there's a lot of enthusiasm for seeing how things develop to combat dengue viruses can be applied, for example, to transmission of malaria. I think that there are many more people who are interested in what could happen with malaria. And that may change because dengue is definitely emerging at this point. But I think a lot of people are interested in how the technologies we've been developing would transfer blocking transmission of malaria.
And Thomas and I spoke about a little bit about the potential downsides of this. Well, it doesn't sound like there are many. Do you see many downsides to this?
Well, I think as scientists, the thing that we're most concerned about is that it won't work. We put a lot of effort into this technology, in which we try to have design features that would prevent it from being risky to use or hazardous to use, try to eliminate off-target effects, but based on the genetic engineering design. And so I think as scientists, our greatest concerns are that we put a lot of effort into something, and if it doesn't work, that's the hazard to us.
Uh-huh. Now, as you well know, GMOs in food, genetically modified organisms, have been quite controversial, particularly in Europe. Have you gotten that kind of a backlash to this? And is there any basis for fearing that this might be a change that, sort of a genie out of the bottle kind of change in terms of a species?
So two kinds of questions there. I wouldn't say it was necessarily a backlash, but I think Tom would agree that we've certainly worldwide generated a lot of conversation and debate. Mm-hmm. And then the question of the genie out of the bottle, the benefits of having engineering properties, so to speak, and working with these organisms is you can set up the initial sorts of things that you're working with to be what are called self-limiting. And these are species or strains that are designed that, if there is a problem, the way you get rid of them is just stop letting them go. And so they have very strong fitness disadvantages. The inability of a female to fly is fatal. Mm-hmm. And so we're working at this as a stepwise process to kind of investigate, these issues associated with unanticipated outcomes.
Yeah, I can see how that would be. And in fact, Thomas was talking about the concern that it might not work. Both of you have mentioned that. And that's sort of that's not the cartoon version. That's not the version of sort of the out of control mutation that takes
right.
over. Which in fact we've already seen that with the non-native species coming in, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think we basically feel that the things that we make in the laboratory generally are going to be less fit than what's there in nature. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's naive of us to assume that we could build something in the laboratory that's just as fit or outcompetes what's in nature. So we need to come up with little tricks. Having said that, that means that the things that we develop have built-in weaknesses, and we would imagine with time that they would just go away. They'd be selected against.
Uh-huh. Now, you both have a colleague, Luke Alfie, who is the owner of Oxitec.
He's a scientific advisor.
Okay.
Chief scientific officer, yeah.
He's working in the Grand Cayman Islands in the Caribbean. What's he working on that's different than what you're working on?
The particular strain that he's working on in the Grand Caymans is not one which is sex-specific. It affects both males and females, and as a consequence, it's a little bit more cumbersome to work with. We think we've had the Mark II version that has a sex specificity in it and would prevent or really reduce greatly the probability of releasing females, which bite people and are annoying and actually transmit the diseases. So we think we've got the second generation product.
Okay. Huh. And one last question for you. We have a problem here in the Valley, a West Nile virus. How might what you're working on impact the future of West Nile?
Well, I think for two different approaches. One is the population suppression, which would reduce the nuisance burden of the mosquitoes. I think that there's something here that's of value to use against those species that you have in the Valley. And then for the longer sort of term things that go after the virus, I think the stuff is directly translatable in terms of the types of science. I mean, the West Nile virus belongs to that broader class of viruses that includes dengue, and that they have an RNA genome, so the kinds of things that we're developing would work against them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Sorry about the phone problems. We've been speaking with Anthony James, a molecular biologist at UC Irvine, and with Thomas Scott, who is working in Mexico, and both on limiting the flying ability of mosquitoes that carry diseases. Thanks for joining both of us. Thank you.
Great. Bye.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the Blind Boys of Alabama. David Watts Barton. Insight is also online, and to tell us what's going on our website is Insight's associate producer, Lynn Weaver. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning, David. Good morning. Glad to be here. Well, we received more comments regarding the plan to privatize the city parking in an effort to generate significant revenue for the Air Arena project. We have contacted city officials asking them to respond, and hopefully we'll have answers for you very soon. On the music front, in a few minutes, you'll hear David speaking with members of the legendary Grammy-winning gospel group, the Blind Boys of Alabama. Their songs have inspired and moved us for decades. My favorite is Go Tell It on the Mountain. And what's yours? Tell us. We want to hear from you. They are playing tonight at the Mondavi Center in Davis. Also tonight, they will join Daryl Hall for a very special 49th edition of Live from Daryl's House. Looking at tomorrow, we'll discuss local efforts to preserve the Transcontinental Railroad from Sacramento to Donner Pass. And Capital Chat returns with SACB reporter Kevin Yamamura, who will update us on the politics of the state budget. Send us an email to insight@capradio.org or write us a comment on our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio. And if you'd like to know more about our guests and our stories, go to our website at capradio.org/insight.
Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you, David.
The Blind Boys of Alabama formed 72 years ago at the Alabama Institute for the Negro Blind in Talladega, Alabama. Since then, they have won numerous Grammys, performed in the musical The Gospel at Colonus, sung live with Tom Petty, Mavis Staples, and Peter Gabriel, and recorded with Willie Nelson and Lou Reed. They appeared in the film The Fighting Temptations and this year's Hop, and they have heard their music used in movies and TV shows like Lost and The Wire. Four of the original seven members have passed, and one is still, and the other is retired, leaving only lead singer Jimmy Carter and Clarence Fountain still performing. And Fountain only tours when his health allows. The current version will be performing Thursday night at the Mondavi Center. I spoke with lead singer Jimmy Carter yesterday. I asked Carter what it was like to be touring after 70 years on the road.
Well, you know, when you love what you do, you know, it keeps you motivated. So it gets a little hectic sometimes, but you know, we realize that, but we love to sing gospel music, and so we just want to keep on going as long as we can.
Yeah, and you're playing 150, 200 shows a year?
That's correct.
Don't you get tired?
Sure you do.
Tell us a little bit about the song "Lead Me Home."
Well, "Lead Me Home," you know, Jamie Johnson came up with the song on the new record "Take the High Road," and you know, it's a good song. I like the song.
Okay, let's listen to it.
I am standing on the mountain.
Standing on the mountain.
Is that your lead they're singing there?
That's me.
That's you. You know, a lot of groups, gospel groups, seem to shy away from pop music, and you still do a lot of gospel, but you seem to have embraced pop music. What is it about it that you like?
We don't embrace it. We have collaborated with secular artists, but you know, we haven't deviated from our gospel music, you know. If this material comes to us and we look at it and we can't put a gospel flavor to it, we don't use it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, even though we collaborate with secular people, we're still the Blind Boys.
So musically, it doesn't change that much for you?
No, it doesn't. No, as long as it's got the gospel message to it. Sometimes you have to change a few of the lyrics to make it into what we want. But no, that's all. It doesn't bother us.
Your most recent album is a collaboration with a lot of country artists. How did that come about?
Oh yeah, we have Jamie Johnson, Hank Williams Jr., Vince Gill, Leanne Womack, and the Oak Ridge Boys. Willie Nelson also.
We have a sample of your track with the Oak Ridge Boys. How did this song come about?
Well, see, Jamie Johnson, he was the co-producer with Chris Goldsmith on this record. He got all these musicians. He got the Oak Ridge Boys. Of course, I've been knowing Oak Ridge Boys for a long time. They're personal friends of mine.
Oh, okay.
And they said whenever we needed them to help us out, just let them know, and they would do it. So we did it, and they did it, and so that's how that came about.
All right, well, let's listen to a little bit of that.
When you feel like you're all alone, get up and take the high road. Oh, Lord.
Take the high road through the valley. Take the high road through the valley. Take the high road through the valley if you want to reach the promised land.
That's an interesting combination. You start off in a real traditional gospel vocal and then end up in a sort of loping country track within about a minute.
Yeah, that's the way it was planned. It was planned that way.
What does it feel like to be singing with that many voices? I mean, you're already singing with a group of terrific voices, but then you throw the Oak Ridge Boys in there, and That's wild.
It sounds great. It was a great experience doing this recording, and we did this recording in Nashville, so with some of the greatest musicians in the world. And I love country music, so I have been lobbying to do a country record for a long time.
Mm.
So when this chance came about, it was great for me. I had the chance to meet some of my country heroes and all that, so I had a ball. I told Jamie Johnson, I said, I have been recording many times, but I've enjoyed this one more than I've enjoyed any of the rest of them.
Is gospel music sort of the common Southern language, what unites maybe white country people and black R&B people?
Yeah, well, you know, gospel is all of it is you know, white gospel, black gospel. It all came out of the same hymn book, so it's not any different. Maybe we sing it just a little different, maybe. But now, as I go now, we're just about doing this, you know, the same way. So I don't see too much difference in it now.
Mm-hmm. When you're singing with that many voices and you're singing gospel music, is it a religious experience for you to do that?
It is, you know, to get all of this great sound and it is sung with the spirit, you know, and so that makes it even better.
How do you like performing with some of the younger guys that you tour with, and then with the Oak Ridge Boys and people like that?
I like it. You know, we started off with Ben Harper and Aaron Neville and those kind of people. So, you know, it was a great experience to be doing things with those people. They're very good. You know.
Mm-hmm. And what do they bring? What do they bring that's new to you?
They enhance our sound, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main thing, and then you know, and they bring more music with it. You know, they bring a lot to the table.
Mm-hmm. You have a track from a recent record that was a very surprising combination of two traditional songs that I think a lot of people wouldn't have expected to hear together. Let's take a listen to that for a second. Inspired that combination of Amazing Grace, which is sort of the classic gospel song, and then House of the Rising Sun?
Well, our producer did that. Our producer, he was a guy from Los Angeles, California. We rejected that song at first.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't like it because, you know, like you say, it's the tune of the, you know, of the House of the Rising Sun. So he said, "Well, let's try. Let's do it. And if y'all still don't like it, we just won't put it out." So we did it, and we told him to try it. And it won the first Grammy the Blind Boy ever had.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah, first Grammy was that song.
Well, it's so surprising because House of the Rising Sun is, of course, sort of the ultimate blues song, and it's about a house of prostitution and Amazing Grace.
That's why we rejected it. But he, by you know, by him being our producer, he was a great persuader.
Well, it's an interesting combination.
Yeah.
What do you have planned for your next album?
Well, we don't know. We're gonna see how this one does first. You know, when I go on stage, I tell the people that we've done this first country record, and this is the first one that we've ever done. So we're testing the water, and I hope we don't drown. So we're gonna see how this one's gonna do. If it does okay, we'll do another one. If it doesn't, we won't.
Okay. Well, you're going to be on a little safer ground at the Mondavi Center on Thursday night because you're doing Christmas music, right?
We're going to do some traditional music and some Christmas music. That's correct.
Okay. What kind of what do you look for when you're looking for good Christmas music that you like?
Well, we do traditional Christmas carol, you know, Silent Night and Go Ted on the Mountain. Thanks. You know, it's song that you know.
It sounds like the blind boys kind of stay the same, and everything comes to them.
Everything comes to us. That's right. that's the way it has to be.
Well, congratulations, and have a great show on Thursday night.
Thank you very much, my friend.
The Blind Boys of Alabama play tonight at the UC Davis Mondavi Center, and you're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a local photographer with ambitious new project. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Now it's time to find out what's happening in the news today with senior editor Alan Ray, who joins us from the newsroom. Alan, what is up?
Well, Governor Jerry Brown and his predecessor Arnold Schwarzenegger are together again, agreeing on one of the few issues of concern they shared. They're at the top of the bill for a conference in San Francisco today titled The Governor's Conference on Extreme Climate Risks and California's Future. The topics include California and global climate change and climate solutions to protect California communities. Other people involved will be the leader of the International United Nations Climate Change Committee and the president's own climate change expert. The land of the free, the home of the brave, increasingly, David, looks like the land of the poor. The latest census data shows nearly half of Americans officially in poverty or living on incomes that qualify as low, too close to poverty. This at a time when states like California are cutting closer to the bone the very programs that are intended to keep the poor from falling over the edge. They used to call that the safety net. Those stories and more from NPR and Capital Public Radio this afternoon beginning at 3:30 on All Things Considered.
Wow, that's interesting news, Alan. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Nicholas Ray is a local Sacramento photographer with a couple of big events on the horizon. One is the opening tonight of his first studio, and he's going to be having a private party for that. The other is a long-range project he's working called Sacramento 100, in which he is photographing 100 local people who are active in the arts community. Nicholas Ray, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, David. Good morning.
So tell us about the project, because that's the one that's going to be consuming a lot of your time in the next year, it sounds like. What are you doing?
So I'm developing a list of 100 people in Sacramento that are culturally influencing and doing something to shape the way Sacramento works.
Of contemporary people, or are you going to be going back at all to older folks, or is this all sort of the new cutting edge people? Or?
People who are doing something right now, you know, as far as like fashion and music, food, things mm-hmm. like that.
And how are you finding people besides just being out and about? And
just pounding the pavement, visiting a lot of stores and restaurants, you know, going to a lot of shows.
Are you taking nominations? Or you know a lot of people around town, or
I'm totally open to suggestions.
Okay, maybe we can ask people to send some suggestions your way. You have a website for the project, right?
Yes, it's Sacramento100.com.
Okay, so if and people can go on there and suggest people to shoot.
Yeah, there's a contact form there where people could send me an email if they have someone they think would belong on that list. I have a few open spots, but most of the list has already been made up.
Okay. And you're not from Sacramento. You've been here, what, about 6 years?
Yeah, I grew up in Cincinnati and moved here about 6 years ago, yeah.
And so as a newcomer, you see the town with fresh eyes. What made you want to do this? What is it, being here for 6 years and looking around, what made you want to do this project?
Well, growing up in Cincinnati, it was kind of a big city, and when I got here to Sacramento, I started meeting a lot of people and realizing that a lot of people really know each other, and it's just a really dynamic city, and it's really fun for me. So I've kind of taking I don't know. I really like it here. It's a fun place.
And do you go when you've been looking for people to shoot? Do you go for people who are interesting looking, or do you just go for people who have made contributions that you consider important and then make them look interesting?
As far as the Sacramento 100, I really don't care what they look like. I just want to make sure that these 100 people are, doing something important here. Mm-hmm. And it really, I'm not really the best looking guy, so I'm not the person to judge anybody.
Well, not in terms of, good looking or bad looking, but somebody who's interesting looking or has as a photographer would be somebody who would be somebody you'd want to capture.
Yeah, I'm not really concerned with that. Mm-hmm. I just want to tell a story and show the people who may not know the ins and outs of Sacramento, show those people what we look like,
Mm-hmm. And who are some of the people that you've already shot?
I'm not really letting that out yet.
Oh, come on, give us a couple names out of 100. You could give us 2 or 3.
Well, maybe my face will be on the back cover or something.
Okay, so you have pictures of you. Who else?
I'm not going to let anybody out.
You're not
going
to say. Okay. No. When do you expect to release this?
I'd like to. Well, right now we have like a placeholder online at sacramento100.com. So I'm going to launch the entire website and hopefully have the book published by around this time next year.
Mm-hmm. And you're using Kickstarter to raise money for this?
Yes, I have a Kickstarter approved, and I'm just kind of dialing in the settings on that. Hopefully have that launched soon to start raising money to get it going.
Okay, so this is just starting out.
Well, I've actually been working on it for about a year.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's a kind of a personal project, so I just work on it in my spare time.
Because otherwise you're a professional commercial photographer.
Yeah, and weddings and other things like that. So.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're very short of time today, so we're going to have to wrap it up, but thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, David.
Nicholas Ray is a photographer in town. He's doing a project called Sacramento 100, and if you want to go to sacramento100.com and suggest any potential subjects for interesting cultural and arts people in Sacramento, I'm sure he'd be happy to hear them. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Sound Advice with Gary Vercelli. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. It's been wet out there, but it's going to be clearing up this afternoon, and it'll be mostly clear and breezy tonight, heading into sunny with light breezes tomorrow. Temperatures will be in the mid-50s around our area today, with temperatures dropping into the 30s overnight. In the mountains, we'll have temperatures in the 30s at Tahoe and 40s in Reno, but that's in the daytime. At night, it's going to get very chilly, down into the teens. There will also be a lake wind advisory effect in effect from tonight and into tomorrow morning. Every Thursday on Insight, we feature a local music expert and his or her picks for recent music. Today, we have Capital Public Radio's jazz host, Gary Vercelli, picking some recent jazz releases. Hey, Gary.
Hi, David. Good to see you. And I have to confess that Devin Yamanaka was supposed to be in with you today, one of our jazz announcers, and she got called away at the last minute, so she's picked most of this music, but I have faith in Devin's choices, so I'm going to explain her choices.
All right, good. Mm-hmm. Well, what's up first?
The first one is by a Bay Area artist named Larry Vukovic. He's from Budapest, Hungary, and he's been in the fixture in the Bay Area jazz scene for quite a while. This is a tune written by Sonny Clark, kind of a legendary West Coast jazz pianist. He had some Blue Note albums out. And Larry surrounds himself with really good company here. Scott Hamilton is on tenor, taking the first solo, which I think we'll hear a little bit of. And also another kind of a unsung hero in the Bay Area, Noel Jukes, is featured on tenor saxophone, two tenors in the front line.
Great. Let's listen to it. Larry Vukovic. That's Larry Vukovic from the Bay Area, one of our choices in Sound Advice today with Jazz with Gary Vercelli and the absent Devin Yamanaka, some of her choices. What do you have next?
Coming up next is a big band album by Christian McBride. And Christian was originally commissioned by the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra to form a big band and do some charts in 1995, and he rose to the occasion. He's one of the preeminent bassists in contemporary music, but running a big band has its own set of challenges. I think he did a good job. This is called Bluesin' in Alphabet City.
That's Christian McBride with a big band. The album's The Good Feeling, a big band.
Yeah, and Blues in Alphabet City. Reading
cool.
From his liner notes here, he says, actually, when I wrote this in 95, Alphabet City, a neighborhood in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, still had some blues in it. Ain't much blues there now, but it's nice and safe with college students walking around with their lattes.
It's true. I was just there a couple weeks ago.
You know, anybody
exactly
who's
right.
been to New York, I remember when Times Square was pretty seedy.
Oh, yeah.
But it was a lot of fun. It had character. And now, you know, I think one of the comics the other night said, yeah, I went to New York and I saw Starbucks and TGI Friday and... You know, it's become very homogenized.
There's a Starbucks on every corner. Although I have to say, Times Square is pretty spectacular now. It wasn't like that back in the day, but
right.
It's not quite as colorful as it used to be in the more down low kind of way. What else have you got? This is a familiar name.
Yeah, this is Clint Eastwood's son, Kyle Eastwood. He's a rising star on the bass, and he's really blossoming as a composer. Let's take a listen.
And he looks a lot like his dad too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Clint's done a lot for jazz over the years by putting Johnny Hartman and many other jazz artists in his scores. But he also did a nice production here by producing a son who plays very well.
All right, let's listen to Kyle Eastwood. That's Kyle Eastwood. He's the bass player. You don't hear a lot of bass on there.
No, but he's, like I said, a burgeoning composer. That's called Cafe Calypso. And one thing I like about Kyle is he's able to kind of walk the fence between straight-ahead jazz, smooth jazz, modern jazz. He kind of does it all. And he also has an international flavor. His album here reflects songs from the Chateau that he spends a fair amount of time in France. So... He's on the rise, and he was really the highlight of the Monterey Jazz Festival a couple years back. I'm very impressed with him.
Really? And how big a band? It looks like he has got a five-piece band?
Yeah, yeah. He gets good top improvisers in his bands.
It's a nice big sound.
Mm-hmm. For that amount of
For that number
musicians.
Of musicians, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we have one more. Who's this?
Well, this one's one I picked out, and it's one I feature quite frequently on Acid Jazz.
Oh, Motion Worker.
On Friday night. And Motion Worker's real name is Adam Dorn, and he's the son of Joel Dorn. Joel Dorn was a famous jazz producer who produced Eddie Harris and Les McCann, many of those great old Rahsaan Roland Kirk Atlantic albums. And I guess it's in the bloodline because Adam Dorn is a very soulful guy. This is a fun record.
Yeah, and so this is Motion. Adam Dorn, known as Motion Worker, and the album is called Candygram for Mowo.
Uh-huh.
Okay, let's listen to a track from that. That's Motion Worker, Adam Dorn, and I think of him as being kind of a DJ as much as anything. How does this all put together?
He surrounds himself with really talented people. He samples Rahsaan Roland Kirk and other musicians, Eddie Harris from his dad's archives. Chiefly, though, what attracts me to his music, it sounds like a party that I'd like to be at this Saturday night. So it's very funky and very, very soulful.
And he's also got Lyrics Born on here. The rapper.
Yeah, that might be one of the tracks that we'll have to save until after 10 o'clock at night.
Okay, well, Gary Vercelli, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
And let's run down one more time the artists that you played.
Well, we ended up there with Motion Worker, and we also heard from Larry Vukovich at the top of the set, Christian McBride, and his big band, and Christian you can find in all different configurations, and then Kyle Eastwood, Clint Eastwood's son, who's got a big career ahead of him, I think.
All right, great. Well, that's sound advice for this Thursday. Gary Vercelli, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight's assistant producer is James Morrison. Today's associate producer was Lynn Weaver. Our technical director is Mark Jones, and today's engineer was Evan Matzler. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Mid-year funding cuts to schools, in-home care, and other state services have been the talk of the Capitol this week. On the next Insight, we'll talk about this in our weekly Capitol Chat. Also, a filmmaker is trying to preserve the Transcontinental Railroad's route through Donner Pass. And Sacramento's bi-weekly music publication, Submerge Magazine, just issued its 100th edition. I'm David Watts Barton. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capitol Public Radio.